This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Joining me now is John Holdren. He was director of the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy under President Obama, basically the president's top science advisor, and he held that position longer than anyone ever has. So we thought he'd be in a good position to provide some perspective on what's happening right now in the Trump administration. John, it's good to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, President Trump has yet to replace you. He has not yet appointed nominated a science advisor. What, if anything, should we read into that?
I'm not sure how much we should read into it at this point. It's pretty clear that science and technology policy is not very high on President Trump's agenda at this point. President Obama, in the corresponding situation, had already nominated me for the position by late December of 2008. It is not a great sign that President Trump has not yet put forward a name for the position. The position, of course, is a dual one. It offers advice directly to the president on science and technology issues that are germane to the policy questions before the president. But it also, the position is also responsible for running the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which has a coordinating role on science and technology issues all across the administration. It has a major role on science and technology budgets, particularly the research and development budgets. Those are worked out in concert with the departments and agencies and the Office of Management and Budget, and the OSDP director makes a final recommendation to the president, along with the OMB director, of what the administration should be putting into science and technology, into research and development. It is responsible for coordinating policies across the roughly 25 departments and agencies that have science and technology roles. And to leave all of that vacant, to leave that unattended at the leadership level is not a great idea.
As I understand it, the science advisor position goes back to FDR and Harry Truman. The 40s were the first time there was a science advisor. And presidents subsequently have opted not to fill one or the other, I guess, of these positions. You're saying there's really two positions.
It's
the science advisor and
a dual-hatted position.
And is it required? I mean, it sounds like not having a director of OSTP would be difficult.
Yeah, OSTP is, since 1976, a statutory office. It was created by act of Congress in 1976 after Richard Nixon had abolished its predecessor. The predecessor was called the Office of Science and Technology, and President Nixon was not happy with the advice he was getting from his Office of Science and Technology. He had a science advisor, Dr. Ed David. He fired his science advisor, and he dissolved the Office of Science and Technology. And the Congress in 1976 decided the executive branch really needed such an office, and so it restored it by law. So it would be difficult to do away with OSTP because it was created by statute. Of course, it could be done away with another law passed by Congress and signed by the president. But absent that, OSTP would continue. The other hat, the one usually called the president's science advisor, has the title Assistant to the President for Science and Technology. And the president has at his disposal who he is going to name assistants to the president and for what. So a president could certainly elect not to appoint an assistant to the president for science and technology, but he would be hard-pressed not to appoint a director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, again, because it's a statutory office.
You and President Obama had a fairly close working relationship, and you've said it's important that the president trust the science advisor and have a bit of a relationship with the science advisor, because it's important that the president be able to hear scientific information that maybe he doesn't want to hear, that's maybe inconvenient or conflicts with previously held ideas.
That's absolutely right.
Do you think unique or special to a science advisor, or is that, you know, equally true of all cabinet positions?
No, I think if you look at who is around the president, even more than cabinet secretaries, it's the chief of staff, and the deputy chiefs of staff. It's the national security advisor and the deputy national security advisor. It's the head of the National Economic Council, the head of the Domestic Policy Council. Those people, including the director of OSTP and the assistant to the president for science and technology, they typically see the president much more often than cabinet secretaries do. They are in the White House or the White House complex with the president and meet with him frequently. It is, of course, important that the president have confidence in his cabinet secretaries as well, and obviously the most important ones in that respect. He's got to have confidence in his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, his Secretary of the Treasury, but really all of them. And to the extent that the president doesn't have confidence and trust, he should be looking for somebody else to fill those posts. But I would say in the case of the science advisor to the president, one of the things a president is looking for from a science advisor is advice that is independent of the agendas of any particular department or agency. He wants to be able to turn to the science advisor and say, well, this is what I'm hearing from the Department of Defense about the capabilities of ballistic missile defense. What do you think? Is this right? This is what I'm hearing from NASA about the next big space mission. Do you think that's the best way to spend $2 billion? And again, it is important in that connection that the president have some confidence that what his science advisor is telling him in response to those questions is a balanced and unbiased view.
Now, there are two names that have come up as possible candidates for a science advisor to President Trump. Both are physicists. One is at Princeton University, William Happer. The other, Yale University, a computer scientist, not a physicist, David Gelertner. Both have contradicted the scientific consensus on climate change, downplayed the risks of climate change. How controversial would either of these be as a science advisor?
I think it would be controversial at this point if President Trump appointed a science advisor who is a climate skeptic, particularly if the person was a climate skeptic without benefit of having been a climate scientist. At the same time, there are a lot of issues that a science advisor has to cover. And President Trump has not shied away from appointing controversial folks to other positions. So I would not want to predict what President Trump is going to do in this space. I personally think it would be unfortunate if the science advisor to the president was a climate change skeptic.
Climate policy is one of the areas that you are most known for in working with President Obama as science advisor. And the New York Times reported yesterday that a group of Republican elder statesmen, including two former secretaries of state and a former secretary of the Treasury, have put forward a plan for a tax on carbon. They're calling it a conservative, free market, small government response to climate change. How important a development do you think that is?
I think it's a very important development. It has been true for many years now that economists of conservative leaning as well as economists of progressive leaning have been united in arguing that the most efficient way to reduce carbon emissions is to tax carbon emissions. This particular proposal follows a number of others that have been put forward by different groups in different parts of the political spectrum in saying that the money should be rebated basically on a per capita or a per family basis, which would avoid the regressive character that a carbon tax might otherwise have. I think this proposal is to be welcomed. There is really no question that a carbon tax is a more efficient and a more comprehensive way to encourage reductions in carbon emissions. And it does it in a way that relies on the marketplace to find the most cost-effective ways to reduce those emissions. The rebate proposition is one that should make it attractive to all parts of the political spectrum and not just the conservatives who want to see less intrusive regulation and more reliance on the marketplace. I think it will be awkward for Republican leaders in the Congress and for the Trump administration to dismiss this proposal outright. And I very much hope that they will not dismiss it.
Any thoughts or comments on the fact that this plan is coming out now instead of sometime in the past 3-4 years as you and President Obama were really pushing for some sort of federal action on climate change?
Well, I think the timing has to be understood in context. And the first part of the context is, again, that there have been similar proposals coming out at intervals for years from different parts of the political spectrum. They have not gotten a tremendous amount of traction because, of course, since 2010, the Republicans in Congress have been in a position to block congressional action of any comprehensive sort on climate change. I think what has changed since in terms of the context is, number one, the symptoms of damage from climate change have become ever more pronounced in recent years. So we're seeing more heat waves, we're seeing more wildfires, larger annual areas burned, we're seeing more violent downpours, more of the precipitation falling in extreme events that produce flooding and landslides and so on. People all around the country as well as all around the world are sensing in their own experience, if not as well what they're seeing on television, that the climate is changing, it's changing in damaging ways, and the voices saying we need to do something about it are becoming more and more pervasive, and they're spread across the political spectrum. And so I think the timing is really very good. A new administration has just come in. It hasn't formulated many of its policies yet. And so I think the time is ripe for a proposal coming from a bunch of influential Republicans who've held high offices in Republican administrations and very distinguished economists among them, Marty Feldstein, who was Ronald Reagan's chief economic advisor. I think the time is absolutely right. And again, I look forward to the discussion that will ensue. You know, if people don't believe climate change is happening at all, of course, this gives them a basis to oppose a tax on carbon, saying, well, it'll just be a drag on the economy. We don't need it because climate isn't changing. But I think fewer and fewer people are willing to take the position that climate is not changing or to take the position that human activities are not the main cause of the changes we're now experiencing. And so I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion that now follows. It cannot be rejected as a liberal conspiracy, given the signatories of this proposal. It can't be dismissed as regressive because of the rebate proposition. And it offers the Republicans who oppose, quote, intrusive regulation, a way to address the climate change challenge while reducing that intrusiveness. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
That's John Holdren. He was President Obama's top science advisor. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with John Holdren. He was director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy and President Obama's top science advisor for nearly 8 years. Climate change, as we said, was a huge part of what you did, your work with President Obama, but obviously not everything. I mean, you've got all of science and technology. What are you most proud of?
Well, of course, I am very proud of the Climate Action Plan, which the president produced after it became apparent that congressional action was not going to be possible. The Climate Action Plan, basically using all the levers that the executive branch has at its disposal to address the climate change challenge. I'm also very proud of the initiatives that the Obama administration produced in the domain of biomedicine and public health, dealing with influenza, dealing with Ebola, dealing with antibiotic resistance, the Combating Antibiotic Resistance Initiative, the BRAIN Initiative, to better understand how the brain works in order to be able to more effectively address Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, post-traumatic stress syndrome, traumatic brain injury. The Precision Medicine Initiative, combining genomics, big data and big data analytics and electronic health records to enable therapies and prevention to be better matched to the characteristics of individual patients. I think this set of biomedical initiatives, including finally the cancer moonshot, is enormously important in the quest for getting better health outcomes for more Americans at lower costs, which was one of the big obviously, priorities of the Obama administration from the outset. I'm proud of what we did in STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math education, where we had the Master Teacher Corps, the 100K-in-10 program to produce 100,000 new highly qualified science and math teachers in a decade. The Educate to Innovate initiative, which produced $1 billion in philanthropic private sector and academic contributions to lift our game in K through 12 science and math education. I think this is changing the picture for the United States in a crucial way, because lifting our game in STEM education is crucial not just to ensuring U.S. continuing leadership at the cutting edge of science and technology. It's crucial to having the tech-savvy workforce that the jobs of the 21st century increasingly require. It's crucial to having the science-savvy citizenry that democracy requires at a time when more and more of the issues in front of our elected leaders have science and technology content. I'm proud of what we did to rebuild U.S. participation in international science and technology cooperation in domains that really matter to us as well as to other countries. Cooperation on clean energy, cooperation on influenza, where it's of great benefit to us, for example, to collaborate with the Chinese because that's the part of the world where influenzas mostly originate. And by collaborating with them, we get extra notice of what we need to be prepared for in terms of vaccine development. So that domain has been very important. I'm very proud of what this president did in bringing more scientists, technologists, and innovators into government. No administration has ever done anything like the combination of creating the first chief technology officer for the U.S. government, the first chief information officer, the first chief data scientist, and then propagating those kinds of positions across the departments and agencies, or the presidential innovation fellows who came from the most innovative industries and the most innovative universities to serve terms of 1 to 2 years in government as troubleshooters, as problem solvers across the departments and agencies, bringing the insights from the private sector and the cutting edge in academia of how technology can be brought to bear to make government more effective, making that happen.
I mean, in his first inauguration address, President Obama promised to, quote, restore science to its rightful place. Is that what you think happened?
Yes, I do think it happened. And we, in fact, published an exit memo from the Office of Science and Technology summarizing how this president was able to put science in its rightful place and all the things that that meant, from bringing in more scientists, technologists, and innovators into government and spreading them across the departments and agencies, to the biomedical initiatives, to making sure that scientists and engineers were at the table in every discussion of policy where science and engineering might have something to contribute, in lifting up the biomedical initiatives, in basically reprioritizing programs at NASA to restore the balance so that we had not only human exploration of space, robotic missions, space telescopes, aeronautics, and looking downward as well as looking upward, the extremely important role of NASA and NASA satellites in understanding what's happening on the surface of the Earth. The set of people that President Obama brought into government in the science and technology space and the room he gave them to innovate, to be creative, the support he gave them, the way he embraced these initiatives is really, I think, unprecedented in modern times. I like to say that President Obama has been the most science-savvy president since Thomas Jefferson, but there's a lot more science to be savvy about today.
There certainly is. You know, one of the first actions from the Trump administration was clamping down on social media and public communication coming out of USDA and EPA, you know, some said, well, this is just the normal process of trying to kind of slow things down and quiet things down as a new administration gets its footing and establishes its own policy. On the other hand, a lot of people said this is censorship of science and just, you know, the first step toward what we expect to be a whole onslaught on the integrity and the place of science in government. Where do you fall on that?
I think it's too early to be sure, frankly. On the one side, it is true that every new administration would like to get its arms around the programs, the policies, and the priorities before a huge amount of communication takes place about the details. That is a natural inclination in new administrations. On the other side, the degree, the extent, and the draconian character of some of what this new administration has done to try to quash communications, commentary from the departments and agencies, and not just the scientists, but others in those departments and agencies, seems unusually aggressive in that respect. And that worries a lot of folks. It worries me. We need to see what happens going forward. I still retain at least some optimism that the Trump administration will, in fairly short order, step back from these kinds of restrictions. But if it doesn't, I think there will be a big outcry, not just from the science and technology community, but from the broader community interested in transparency, openness, and integrity in government. And again, if they do not step back from, or indeed if they even accentuate these kinds of restrictive policies, I will be among those speaking out.
What are the biggest science challenges that you see facing the Trump administration? And what advice would you give to President Trump and any future science advisor in trying to address them?
Well, you know, I'm biased on this matter. I think that the biggest challenges are the ones that the Obama administration emphasized. Again, one of those challenges is being able to attract and retain high-caliber science, technology, and innovation talent in the government. Another challenge is taking advantage of the extraordinary recent progress in genomics, in proteomics, in microbiomes, in big data analytics to advance our ability to get better health outcomes for more Americans at affordable cost. I think the energy climate challenge remains the most daunting technological and scientific challenge on our horizon. Global climate change is an immensely dangerous problem, dangerous not just in the usual environmental terms, but dangerous to our economy, dangerous to our security. The Pentagon has understood it. The intelligence community has understood it. The economics community has understood it. We really need the Trump administration to embrace a forward-leaning agenda on clean energy, on climate change mitigation and adaptation, and on international engagement on addressing the climate change challenge. And that includes a very energetic program of Earth observation and analyzing the data from Earth observation to better understand exactly what is happening and where and what is likely to happen going forward. STEM education remains an enormous challenge. We've made progress on science, technology, engineering, and math education. We need to make more if the United States is to remain a world leader, including economically. Again, the role of science, technology, and innovation in economic progress is immense. Most economists agree that between 50 and 80% of productivity increases over the last half century and more have come from science, technology, and innovation. These should not be partisan issues. That is, improving public health, advancing the economy, protecting us against the potential ravages and even the ongoing ravages of climate change, these should be bipartisan issues. And it is to be hoped that the Trump administration will recognize that these are not political issues. They are issues of national well-being. If they do recognize that, one of the things that the Obama administration has done that they will want to continue is relying heavily on partnerships between levels of government, the federal government, state governments, and local governments, partnerships across sectors between the public sector, the private sector, the academic sector, the civil society sector. The Obama administration pursued those kinds of partnerships in terms of advanced manufacturing, strengthening manufacturing in this country and generating new manufacturing jobs. It pursued them in the STEM education space, where there's been tremendous collaboration between the philanthropic sector, the academic sector, and the private sector. Pursued them in the space domain, space exploration, with privatizing important parts of NASA's missions, so that we're relying on private providers to take cargo into low Earth orbit to the International Space Station, and we will be increasingly relying on private providers to take astronauts into low Earth orbit. Collaborations of industry, of business, of government, of academia have a power based on harnessing the comparative advantages of each of these sectors that enable us to get much more done than we would get done in the absence of partnerships. And I would strongly urge the Trump administration to recognize and take advantage of that potential, as the Obama administration did.
As you are returning to civilian life, so to speak, and you said you'll be keeping tabs on the new administration, I wonder where you turn to find the news and information that you need, and find it in a trustworthy way. I mean, this has become such an issue in recent months, in the past year or so, the issue of fake news and trying to find news outlets that are actually covering the issues in the way that they should be covered. So where do you go for your information?
What can I say? I listen to NPR, naturally.
And I didn't tell you to say that.
You didn't. I listen to NPR. I watch CNN and the network news. And I read the newspapers still. I read the New York Times. I read the Washington Post. I often read the Wall Street Journal, where I would say the reporting is much better than the editorial page. And of course, I look online. You need a filter, of course, to look online. You have to have some sense of what's likely to be real and what's likely to be fake. But all those sources of information are important.
John Holdren was President Obama's top science advisor and director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy for nearly 8 years. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Heather.